The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Today, I'm really excited to speak with Dan Pink on the podcast. Pink is the author of 6 provocative best-selling books, including his newest, When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. His other books include A Whole New Mind, Drive, and To Sell Is Human. Pink's books have won multiple awards and have been translated into 38 languages. Hey, nice to chat with you today, Dan.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Boy, you know, we cover quite a wide range of topics in this podcast. You've covered a wide range of topics in your own writing. Do you see like a core thread that runs through all of them?
Not really. I mean, there certainly wasn't. Yeah, right. No, I mean, there's certainly, I can guarantee you this, there's no intentional designed thread. It's not like I have some master plan out there, put it mildly. I think that, you know, maybe there is a thread that is visible retrospectively.
Yeah.
And it's something that maybe readers can see more than I. I mean, if there's any sort of common denominator, it might be that I tend to write a lot about, not even exclusively, I tend to write a fair amount about work, just because I think work is a really interesting domain in which to study what makes us tick. But no, just making it up as I go along, like everybody else.
Yeah, but I do find that interesting that like I notice that I learn things about myself when I read enough of my work over a long period of time, and I look back and I'm like, wow, something emerged here from my that actually reveals something about my soul. And I was wondering if you've noticed anything that kind of you like go, wow, I'm really kind of obsessed with this X, Y, and you know.
You know what? I am not that introspective, I guess. I have not. It's not. I probably should be more introspective. It's not anything that I have really considered. Maybe it's worth doing.
Fair enough. It's not a requirement.
Yeah.
So let's start with your book, Drive. Lots of meat in there that has areas of mutual interest. Can you start with the outdated notion of motivation that, shall we say, motivated you to write Drive in the first place?
Yeah. What's interesting about the stuff in that book, which is, as you know, Scott, is based on, you know, about 50 years of research in behavioral science, is that there's nuance to it. Every once in a while, the nuance gets lost. And basically, the big idea there is that there's a certain kind of motivator that we use in organizations. Psychologists like you call it a controlling contingent motivator, okay? I like to call it an if-then reward, as in, if you do this, then you get that. If you do this, then you get that. Now, here's the thing. We use all kinds of rewards in organizations, especially all kinds of rewards. But this is in some ways the mainstay reward. And what the research tells us about if-then rewards, not about all rewards, but about if-then rewards in particular, is that they're pretty good for simple algorithmic tasks with short time horizons. They're less good for more complex tasks with longer time horizons. And the problem is that in organizations, especially, we use them for everything. And so they can be effective for very routine short-term tasks, but they're less effective for tasks with longer time horizons and that they require more conceptual thinking. So we use them for everything. When we don't work in the second category, instead of saying, hey, we need a new approach, we just say, hey, those carrot and stick motivators didn't work. Oh, let's have some more carrots. Let's have crunchier carrots. Let's put carrots with honey glaze on them. Mm. Or, you know, even the sticks, it's like, oh, let's have sharper sticks. Let's poke people in the eye 4 times rather than just 3 times. And it carries down a wrong
path. Do you mean motivate people by saying you'll only poke them twice instead of 3 times? Is that what you mean?
Really motivating people like, oh.
Because that'll demotivate.
People aren't responding very well because we're only poking them twice in the eye. Let's poke them. Let's poke them 3 times in each eye for a total of 6. And that'll really get them motivated to. Yeah. So it's just a little bit outdated. But again, I mean, you know, there is nuance here. And so sometimes people say, oh, human beings are so noble, they don't respond to rewards, which is nonsense. Mm. It's almost as much as nonsense as people who say human beings respond only to contingent rewards.
Yeah. And I love how you put this nuance in there. And you certainly don't say that in the workplace, we should completely eliminate external rewards.
Not at all. So, and it's not only external, internal. It's
right.
Basically
that's
contingent
true.
And non-contingent. And
that's
so
right.
An external reward is like salary. It's like, yeah, should people be paid a salary? Yeah. People should be paid a high salary. Like right. there's a very good argument rooted in psychological science, even in economic science, on the importance of paying people healthy salaries. You can make the psychological argument, but you can also make an economic argument that if you pay people, I mean, George Ekerlof made this argument, you know, if you pay people more than the market, like we got a market clearing wage, right? So we know that there's a certain range, like I'm in Washington, D.C. So let's say I'm at an insurance company and I want to hire a corporate auditor with 6 years of experience. Okay, there's going to be a salary range there. And what George Ekerlof said in some of his research is that, hey, pay people a little bit outside of that range, higher than that range. It's like, why would you ever do that? And it turns out that what it does, well, first of all, it raises the opportunity cost of quitting. Second of all, it basically eliminates all grievances about fairness. And so people can just focus on the work. So yes, pay people well. But this idea that you can constantly calibrate and manipulate people with these contingent rewards is a complete fallacy.
I want to bring up something that not many people are familiar with this idea. I've really digged into the writings of Abraham Maslow, who, as you know, was a seminal motivational researcher and theorist. He had this idea of meta pay. So he argued that self-actualized people shouldn't be paid in what other people are so concerned of, people who are lower in the hierarchy, but those who are kind of higher and more self-actualized, they get more excited by the reward of virtue or the reward of like feeling like they've done something good. And he actually made the case that like if we pay self-actualized people meta pay and we pay the other workers more with actual money, the people who care about the money, then they'll be less likely to resent the people who are self-actualized. It's actually kind of an interesting argument about human nature.
It is an interesting argument. No, it's very interesting. And, you know, as you know, being a Maslow expert, I mean, it's really, you know, Maslow didn't do all that many experiments and did a lot of theorizing. And this is a fascinating theoretical concept. I think you could run aground the other way in that let's say it's you and I, and I'm getting very high meta pay, and you're getting a lot of money pay. If you're getting more money pay than I am, I think I might have a problem with that.
The self-actualized people will get jealous of.
Well, right,
I mean,
right.
It's an interesting question.
Because of fairness, the human beings are just exquisitely attuned to this norm of fairness. It's an interesting idea, and it's actually adjacent to some of the other ideas here, which is that, you know, one of the things that we do know from a lot of research is that purpose is a pretty powerful motivator, and maybe purpose is. Maybe purpose and meta pay are siblings.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's
totally. Yeah.
So purpose and meta pay. And so we know from a lot of research that, you know, that fundraisers will work a little harder if they get to meet the people who benefit from their fundraising, for instance.
Yeah.
There's a great, lovely piece of research out of Harvard Business School from a couple of years ago where they had cooks in a cafeteria. You know, this research, they had cooks in a cafeteria that usually could not see the customers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you rigged up an iPad in the cafeteria line so that the cooks could see the customers. And when they did that, they were measuring the dependent variable was the quality of the food, not mm-hmm. satisfaction or anything like that. And when cooks could see the customers, the quality of the food improved.
Mm.
That's in some ways a sibling of meta pay. So I think that Maslow, as with many, many, many things, sort of in his brilliant fertile mind was onto something big. It's that whole thing about, what is that book that he wrote? It's very hard to read. It has a very complicated first adjective name, but it's like Ephesygian management or something like that.
Yeah, Eupsychian management.
Eupsychian management, right, which I found a very hard book to read. And yet contains, I think, a lot of the seeds of much of contemporary management thinking today.
So that's awesome that you read that. Not many people are aware of that book.
I can't pronounce the name, but I couldn't think of the name.
It was like, no, I'm impressed that you read it. And actually, that book is actually a collection. It's actually his journals from a particular summer he spent observing. And all those things are dictations. So if they're hard to understand, it's because he dictated things into a tape recorder.
What kind of company was that? It was like an electrical?
It was a management. It was like they produced electronics.
Yeah,
I produced electronics. But when he went into, he didn't plan on really enjoying that job. He wasn't interested in management or business beforehand. He thought, oh, good, this would be an opportunity for me to go out west and do my writing on what I'm really interested in, which was like religion. And he was at that time, he was working on peak experiences in religion. And then he was like, holy cow, like these workers are so motivated, they feel such great pride for their work. And they were applying his theory of self-actualization in the workplace. And so he dropped all the other work he was doing. And as he writes, he dictated in Eupsychian management, he says, I used to think education was the main place where we can learn the most about human nature, et cetera. Now I'm convinced it's the workplace. So that actually was a shift the summer of 1962. Yeah. Go on and on and on about Abraham Maslow.
But it's interesting because that connects to the first question, because I think one of the reasons that I'm interested in writing about work, I think one of the reasons why I've been drawn to writing about work, at least for the first, several books I've written, is precisely that first of all, if you think about just how much time people spend at work, all right, it's over half of their waking hours.
Sure.
And then if you think about what goes on, it's everything. It is how to group coordinate, how do conflicts emerge, how does stuff get done, what do people find, what tasks are valuable, what do people find valuable, how are people effective? And it's like everything. It's like basically what it is to be, not fully what it is to be a human, but it becomes this scope through which you can look at the entire human condition.
Yeah, it sounds like you're like learning about your own thread throughout the course of this podcast as it goes on.
Maybe this is a what is it? Eupsychian?
Eupsychian. Like the good society. Like the society that's self-actualized.
Maybe this is a Eupsychian podcast.
Oh my gosh! Maybe I should actually. I've been thinking about changing the psychology podcast name, by the way. And I'm like, maybe I should call it the Eupsychian podcast, but no one would.
Call it Eupsychian today. How about that?
If I do that, do I have to give you some royalties now for?
Absolutely not.
Not like I make any money anyway.
If you do that, the only thing I'll get from you are angry texts saying, why the heck did you make me do this? If no one knows what Eupsychian means.
Yeah, and no one does, except me and you now. But let's talk a little bit about this interesting model, because I know that you built on the work of CC and Ryan. Is that right?
Absolutely.
And you extended it in very interesting directions, made it very accessible. So it's not just the same thing as their model by any stretch of the imagination. But there is something I want to discuss about their model. They have this motivational continuum. And you're quite right that external versus internal is way too simplistic. But they do have this motivational continuum from a motivation to external pressures, like you said, that would be the carrots. To internal pressures. We have internal pressures like guilt and ego involvements and pressures we put on ourselves, and to value, and then to full intrinsic, like I just find this intrinsically enjoyable, my work is. What do you think of that continuum? How much did you draw on that in your own book?
For me, it started to get more complicated when you get to things like introjection, which they, an idea that they introduce. Mm. I don't find that as compelling as some of the other things.
By the way, that came from Carl Rogers.
Oh, really?
Another humanistic psychologist.
Yeah. So I found the introjection less compelling. What I found really compelling are these, a lot of their research, especially even the cross-cultural research on autonomy as a fundamental attribute of who human beings are, that human beings do inherently want to be self-determined. And looking at their research and just thinking of just my own interpretation of life is I really think that is the default human condition. I don't think it's the condition of every person today by a long shot, but I do think it is the default human condition. And I think it's a powerful way of understanding. And also I think that their research and others showing all the ways these contingent rewards can go awry is really valuable. But some of the stuff I found less, introjection being the best example of that, I found less compelling.
Well, let's think that through for a second. Isn't it possible? And I know that you talk about importance of grit as well and flow as part of autonomy. Is it possible to be really unhealthily autonomous? And I think that's why I personally like the interjection part of it, because it's like, you know, you could be autonomous, but you could be doing the wrong goals. It could be purely driven by insecurity and ego. Yeah.
Absolutely.
But you're still autonomous.
Yes and no. I mean, that's again, where you can, again, as you say, exactly, that's where interjection can come in. So the question is, if you are doing things out of a sense of guilt or pressure, is that truly self-determined? And
that's a good
and
point.
The answer would be probably not. But, and I think it's an important question. For me, there's a certain point when you're writing for a popular audience, that is, there are certain kinds of debates within the field that I find like really interesting to talk about, but that actually, you know, one secret of writing is, what do you leave out? Yeah. And to me, that's in the category of what do you leave out? So if someone asks me a question about it, it's like, heck yeah, let's talk about it. Let's talk about whether feeling guilt, you know, whether feeling guilty is actually a form of self-determination or actually runs afoul of self-determination. Woohoo! That's a room emptier for most people. And so it's to me, you know, that's worth leaving. It's worth leaving out in that particular context.
A thought occurred to me as you're saying this. I should probably clarify what I mean by it after I say it. But you're kind of like the Stephen King of nonfiction writing. You know, he talks a lot in his beautiful book on writing, you know, how he needs to kill his darlings, you know.
Oh, yeah, totally, totally.
To tell the good story. I want to clarify, your writing's nothing about horror, though.
No, it's horrifying to some people, I'm sure. And would that I have been as prolific as Stephen King? The guy's unbelievable.
Well, I was going to say you probably are. No, I was going to say there's a comparison there. You don't think so?
Here's the comparison. We both have four-letter last names, and we both are native speakers of English. And that's, I think, where the comparison ends.
You're Dan Pink.
He's Stephen King.
Exactly, but yeah, okay.
There's a reason they call him the King. No, but
it's on his birth certificate.
I do think that, and I like Stephen King. I actually like reading Stephen King. I read a fair amount of Stephen King.
Me too.
In part because I think reading Stephen King is good for any writers, even nonfiction writers, just because of the propulsiveness of the way that he writes. Just like his ability to keep things moving forward all the time.
Yeah.
It's really just breathtaking the way he does that. But the point about killing your darlings, I think it's even more important in some ways for certain kinds of nonfiction.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I see in certain kinds of nonfiction books is, and I feel the writer's pain on this, is that, hey, I spent all this time, I did this research, and I found this stuff out, and so I want to tell you about it. But if it doesn't move the story or the argument forward, the reader doesn't care.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you gotta, you know, as painful as it is, you gotta leave it out.
Yeah. You do. And it is very painful. I mean, like, I can't do it. I leave it all in and then I give it to my editor and say, do whatever you want with it. Like, but I needed, like, it's almost a compulsive thing. Like, it's like I needed to include it all. And then first stage.
Yeah. The first stage you include, you know, first drafts, you try to include anything, but you actually have to be, I think there's a certain ruthlessness is helpful in writing. And the way I look at it, and as one progresses, you begin to develop that kind of ruthlessness to the point now where I read over something. And I think that every sentence, every word has to explain to me why I shouldn't kill it.
Yeah.
And there you're doing right by the reader. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of books don't always even aspire to that. I'm not sure I managed to achieve that, but I think a lot of books don't aspire to that. There's a lot of, it's like, oh my God, that's like, okay, I really didn't need these two pages just because you did the research one afternoon.
That's right. Yeah, so I really have learned a lot about science writing by reading your work, but it is extraordinarily difficult for me to switch between these radically different modes of thought from journal scientific writing to popular science communication. It's like being multiple personality disorder, right? It's like, you know, I go from this like hyper detailed reviewer comments are like at the level of granularity that would, you know, make your head explode. They make my head explode. And then switching to like where it's like, oh, no, I don't need to include that level of detail, you know, and like there is no picky reviewer. I mean, there are certainly picky critics, but
of course.
But you know what I mean? So it's really hard. Yeah.
Oh, I can totally understand that. And this is the advantage of not having those well-developed journal writing skills.
Yeah. Actually, that's a good point. Yeah. Maybe it's a trade-off.
I don't run into that conflict because there's nothing to conflict with.
Yeah. Yeah, you're more harmonious, integrated human.
I am. I'm actually climbing.
I'm climbing the ladder.
Climbing the ladder, about to have a peak experience.
That's true. Okay. Yeah. So maybe I'll if I want to get more into science writing, I'll suck more in my journal writing. No, I don't know.
Yeah, just stop doing it.
Yeah. Well, I enjoy it too, though. So it's tough when you enjoy multiple things that are so different from each other.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other topic of conversation.
Right.
Let's talk about selling. Can we move into that direction right now? You wrote this really fascinating book, which really laid down, you know, a basic truth about humanity is that, you know, pretty much, even if superficially it looks different, pretty much everything in the world today is in some form of selling, and people's jobs, you know, in certain regards depends on how well you can move someone, move something.
Exactly.
So can you talk a little bit more about this fundamentally? What do you think the fundamental, if you had to think in evolutionary terms, like, you know, other animals, it's not like monkeys are selling to other monkeys, but they are doing something resembling what this drive is.
That's interesting. I haven't thought about it much cross species. It could be something that make humans, I mean, what in evolutionary terms, you know, our brains allow us to do things that other species can't do. And one of the biggest ones is collaborate, even though other primates obviously can collaborate, but also what we also are able to do is collaborate across great distances. And that requires at least some capacity to persuade, woo other people to join your cause. So my hunch is that there probably was an evolutionary advantage to people who were adept at persuasion and influence. It'd be surprising if it didn't, if there wasn't, because the people who weren't adept at that probably didn't get others to go along with them and protect them and do all those kinds of things. It's a really interesting question about other species. I haven't really thought much about it. I wonder whether like the collaborative activity in other species is, we can consider it selling. I haven't thought about that. It probably isn't it probably is in some ways. I mean, there's wooing obviously in species for reproduction, but I don't know. I just don't know enough about it. This one book that I have that I haven't finished.
Yeah.
Back here somewhere, it's
you have a million books behind you
by Franz De Waal, who's at Emory, the primatologist. It's called "Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?" And it makes me curious about that. I don't know a lot about animal thinking.
Well, that's a really good point that he made, and I certainly don't know the answer. But just in thinking about it, it seems like it's more linked to the Machiavellian system we see in monkeys, which is quite developed. You know, it's funny because you use the word cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes that's antithetical to, like, do you distinguish between like dark triad selling and cooperative, like non-zero sum selling? Does that make
sense? Well, I don't even know. Yeah, no, I see where you're going. I mean, one of the arguments of the book, so I would say that dark triad selling is a form of manipulation.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
And whereas I think, and one of the arguments of the book is that kind of selling, that low road kind of selling is becoming tougher today. Because of information parity. That is, like, taking the low road is easy in a world where sellers have huge amounts more information than buyers, where buyers don't have any choices, where buyers don't have a way to talk back. Today, not fully, but today buyers have a lot more information, a lot more choices, and a lot more ways to talk back. So, you know, what you're calling like the dark triad selling, you know, the sort of Machiavellian. What else is in the triad? Like
psychopathy and narcissism.
Yeah, psychopathy. Yeah. Believe me, there's plenty of psychopathy, narcissism, and Machiavellianism in the world. It's just that I actually think in selling, it's less effective these days.
Wow. That would be wonderful if a lot of like dark triad people listen to this podcast and were like, wow, if I just am more cooperative, I can manipulatively get what I want better than, you know, that's actually a sneaky way of getting them to cooperate.
It could be the light version of the dark triad.
Yeah.
But
we're actually working on a paper on that, by the way.
The other thing about it, though, other thing about it is that you have to think about, you know, you use the word zero sum, and I think that's actually a really important way to look at it. Yeah. So are the interactions and are these transactions zero sum or positive sum? And you know, I do think that dark triad personalities look at encounters of all kind as zero sum.
Winning, losing,
And that people who are more self-actualized, to borrow a phrase, probably look at interactions as more positive sum.
That's right, yeah.
Also, you know, if you look at, I mean, it's a great, you know, the connection between this and evolution is a great book by Bob Wright called Non-Zero.
I love that book.
It's a great book. Yeah. And it's all about how, like, you know, the reason we've been able to progress is because we don't think of things as zero sum. We think of encounters as positive sum. You know, like this conversation here, it's like, there's not going to be, at least I hope not, going to be a winner or a loser. Oh, no. It's not, if I win, you lose. If you win, I lose. It's right. Theoretically a positive sum for you, for me, for the listeners. But if I were a narcissistic Machiavellian psychopath, then I might want to use this interview to make me look good somehow at your expense.
Totally.
But of all of the personality afflictions that I have, Dark Triad is not up there.
You know, I mean, we all got something. Come on.
Yeah, totally.
It's called being human. I wanted to make a point. You know, sometimes in the psychology podcast, I don't have fully baked ideas, but I just like to try to articulate them on the spot.
Sure.
So who wins when two people are trying to get at the truth? They both care deeply about not their ego, but the truth.
Yeah.
One person, the person who is better at representing the truth, kind of does win in a sense, but it shouldn't be attached to the ego. You see a lot of times on YouTube, I'm just going to give you an example. You see a lot of times on YouTube, these intellectual debates, and then these people will reframe it as like X person dominates Y person or X person obliterates, you know, and I really can't stand that framing, but you see how it's kind of like reframed when it really is just like a really nice mutual dialogue of two people interested in getting at the truth. But sometimes that's reframed. Have you seen that too on YouTube?
I don't know. I mean, you see it very much in political discussions.
Yes, yes.
And so, you know, I think that, and especially in the press coverage of political discussions, so it's like, you know, is this legislation a win for the Democrats or a loss for the
exactly.
Democrats? You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. It shouldn't
so basically
be like that.
Taking the ethic of sports writing into turning everything into essentially a sports contest. The thing about sports is that at least a particular game is a baseball game is a zero sum contest. Somebody wins and somebody loses. The other thing about baseball games is that the stakes and importance to humanity is limited. So it's fine.
Yeah.
Whereas like political discussions, you would think the stakes to humanity are greater.
What a terrific analogy, because people really do what the human tribalism need. People really do treat their political party like they do a baseball team, you know, and like whatever the party person says, you know, like no matter how crazy or incorrect, untruthful it is, it's like rah, 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 go win. Yeah.
This is the biggest thing going on in American politics. And this is the work of a political, some great work done by a political scientist at Maryland named Liliana Mason, who's basically the herd thesis, which I think is very, very well supported by a whole array of polling data and others. Is that what's happened in this, first of all, in this country in particular, there's been an incredible sorting. Some guy, I can't think of his name, wrote a book called The Big Sort, which is why, you know, people in, you know, if you look at my nine digit zip code, they're going to be a shitload of Priuses and no Cadillacs. And in my nine digit zip code, they're going to be here in Washington, D.C., they're going to be very, very few Trump voters and a lot of Hillary voters. There are going to be very few people who listen to country music and a lot of people who listen to NPR. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's a thing. And so you have this massive sorting by neighborhood, but you also have massive sorting politically so that the first Republican to be elected to the United States Senate was an African American, Edward Brooke. You used to have Southern conservatives who were Democrats. You don't have that anymore. You used to have people like John Lindsay, a liberal Republican. You don't have that anymore. And so what you have now is you have incredible polarization of the parties hinged very much to identity, to the point where you have one party, which is basically a white party, and another party that is largely a non-white party.
Minorities,
And when people, it's basically one party is heavily white, and the other party is heavily non-white, but includes whites who live in urban areas. And so what you have there is when your politics have become hitched entirely to your identity, political conversations, political battles become purely zero sum. And what's at stake is not only winning and losing as in a baseball game, but what's at stake is your identity itself. And so this is why the whole point of politics has become to win.
Yeah.
And this is why you see, so identity trumps identity.
Humanity.
Identity trumps smaller things. Identity trumps ideology.
Yeah.
Identity, which is why you can have a Republican swing in their view of law enforcement or Russia in a flash. Identity trumps ideology. Identity trumps issues. Identity trumps interest. 10 years ago, you had Tom Frank write a book called What's the Matter with Kansas? What could these people in Kansas possibly be doing voting for conservatives when it was against their economic self-interest? And, you know, what they didn't say was, what's the matter with Northwest Washington, D.C.? where you have people who are supporting candidates who are going to raise their taxes against their self-interest. So identity trumps interest, identity trumps ideology, identity trumps issues. It's all about identity, and it's about winning and losing, and that's it. And Mason has this great factoid in there where she talks about Republicans, something like 70% of Republicans believe there's some gun control provision, let's say background checks or safety locks. 70% of Republicans believe in that when you ask them in a poll. But if you ask them, should Congress pass a law to mandate safety locks or whatever, some kind of thing like that, that they agree with, the number who support passing a law to do that goes down to something like 48% because that would be a win for the other guy. So identity, 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 identity. It beats interest, it beats ideology, it beats issues. That's what's going on in this country.
You really nailed it there. And even
I'm repeating the thesis of Liliana Mason, but I've become very convinced about it. Jennifer Richardson at Yale has done some interesting research about how the changing demographics of some really, really interesting research in psychology about how changes in demographics actually make people, in experimental settings, make people more conservative. And not just white people, but, you know, as she says, it's not white people psychology, it's people in general. So there's some big issues going on. But the biggest thing in the country right now is
identity
essentially
politics.
A civil war of identity. It's not politics, it's a civil war. It's an identity civil war.
Identity civil war. Well, you know, if we take it a deeper level than identity, I mean,
I don't know how I got on that dark track, but.
Oh, no. I mean, I love the detours. To me, the detours are more exciting than what's on the to-do list. It's always the case for me. At a deeper level of identity, though, it seems like people are hitching their identity on their ego. There's like something deeper there of like, you know, my ego is at stake or my self-esteem is, you know, as opposed to, oh, there's some transcendent truth is at stake. See, they have very different consequences depending on what you hitch, you know, the identity on.
Totally agree, because I think that identity is hitched. I agree with you completely. Identity is hitched, ego, self-esteem, whatever. It's not about any kind of broader. It's not about any kind of broader truth. And when it's a political battle, you don't want your identity to lose because that's a major, major. That's a major injury. It's an injury. Yeah. It's an injury and a loss for your whole self rather than a legislative. Anyway.
Not anyway. Like, this is really awesome stuff.
Dark triad, identity politics. Who knows what else is next?
No, but this is the interesting. This is what's interesting. But so let me try to do a ninja move here and tie what you said into the next thing I wanted to talk to you about. So, you know, you talk about the new ABCs of attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. Do you think great politicians, you know, not just great ones who are like, they care about humanity, that are good people as well, incorporate these three things when they try to move large segments of their base?
Absolutely.
Was that an okay ninja move?
Yeah, that was good. I think that's right. So attunement is, can you understand someone else's perspective? Can you get out of your own head and see something from someone else's point of view? I think that good politicians are able to do that. Buoyancy is basically, you know, form of resilience. Can you stay afloat in an ocean of rejection? You know, really good politicians are able to do that. And then clarity is, you know, not only accessing information, but curating it, making sense of a welter of information, and then also moving from problem solving to problem finding. And I do think that, you know, skilled politicians are generally pretty good at that. And even the less noble politicians are pretty good at that.
Yeah, for sure. And then in terms of the extroversion, introversion dimension, I really like how you discussed that in your book. It's a topic I'm interested in as well. Is it a myth that you have to be an extrovert in order to have these three things or be good at these three skills?
There is almost no correlation between strong extroversion and sales success. It's a total myth.
Thank you for dispelling that myth.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that strong introverts are better. They're actually not. They're worse. So strong introverts aren't very good at this either. So what really matters, what really the personality that seems to have the greatest success in persuasion, sales, influence are ambiverts, which are most of us, you know, a little bit, you know, the distribution of introversion, extroversion in the population is kind of sort of a bell curve. And so most of us are not, this is all Myers-Briggs' fault because they said, you know, you're an I or an E, when in fact, most of it's spectrum and most of us are somewhere you know, kind of, you know, it's a bell curve basically. And so most of us are sort of in the middle of that bell curve. So I'm an introvert, like on any sort of instrument I would test on, if you give me a choice between I and E, I mean, forget about Myers-Briggs, but on the legitimate
big five. Introvert.
Yeah, exactly. On the big five measure of extroversion, I'm going to come out more introverted than extroverted, but I'm not going to come out as a super strong introvert. And what that means is that I'm basically an ambivert.
You swing both ways.
Yeah, but I mean, there's something about that versatility that's actually really useful when it comes to sales, because, you know, it's like being ambidextrous in sports. You know, you can move to your left, you can move to your right. Whereas being ambidextrous in sales persuasion means that you know when to speak up, but you also know when to shut up. You know when to push, but you also know when to hold back. And so that kind of ambidextrousness is extraordinarily valuable.
I couldn't agree with you more on that note. So let's, next 10 minutes or so, let's conclude this podcast talking about time management. Or managing your life, in this, it's broader than just time management, right? So it's scheduling, you know, like making timing matter. And this covers a whole wide range of things, as you note. Could you want to pick one of the most obscure things, like one of the things people wouldn't necessarily think about would have such a profound effect on one's life if they manage it properly?
Well, I think there's all kinds of groovy stuff on that. The biggest thing is that you know, when we think, to me, it's like the broader category is like our various when decisions, all right? So when should you do something? And that could be over a course of a lifetime, over a course of a project, over the course of a day. I was really intrigued by a lot of the research on midpoints and by the research on endings. That is, a lot of our lives are episodic, you know, so a project, for instance, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Certain kinds of jobs have beginnings, middles, and ends. Certain relationships have beginnings, middles, and ends. And the effect of endings on our behavior, the effect of midpoints on our behavior are really interesting. Midpoints is not anything that I even thought about until I started doing the research for this book, When.
So interesting. And then, well, let's talk about some other things. What about, I mean, a lot of things are very practical. Like, when is the worst time to be a hospital patient?
Oh, God. That's an easy one.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah. So basically, don't go to the hospital in the afternoon if you can avoid it. And the evidence is pretty overwhelming. If you look at like anesthesia errors, 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. If you look at colonoscopies, doctors find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as they do in morning exams. If you look at prescribing of unnecessary antibiotics, much more common in the afternoon versus the morning. If you look at hand washing in hospitals, big decline in hand washing hospitals in the afternoon. So yeah, no, that's among the findings that have been most useful in my own personal life has been that. So my daughter earlier this week had her 19-year-old had her wisdom teeth taken out. And believe me, she had to have general anesthesia. There was no way that she was going for that in the afternoon. She had Eliza had her appointment at 7:30 a.m.
I love that they are applying your research to help your daughter.
Oh, totally, totally, totally. I've done it in other realms. I seriously will not. You know, if I get run over by a bus at 2 in the afternoon, I'm going to go to the hospital. Okay, I'm not going to say, oh, wait till the morning. But if I have discretion over it, no way would I go to an important medical appointment or the hospital in the afternoon. I'll do a routine teeth cleaning in the afternoon, absolutely. You know, go to for that. But if I'm having like oral surgery, there's no way I'm going to go in the afternoon.
This is great. Okay, I'm going to just throw stuff at you and just like give me the answer.
Lay it on me.
Like just go. Give me like tell All me right. Just give like the one word answer, right? So okay, like when should you quit your job?
When you're approaching an anniversary and your job doesn't give you both control and challenge. More than one word.
One sentence is perfectly fine.
Yeah.
When should you get married?
Well, seems like your marriage is slightly more likely to succeed if you get married after you've completed your education, no matter how much education it is, and also between the ages of 25 and 32. You're marginally less likely to get divorced. But again, on that, okay, we're talking about large populations. So if you get married when you're 33, it doesn't mean you're going to get divorced. If you get married when you're 29, it doesn't mean you're going to stay married. I think the most interesting piece of research on marriage is, well, I mean, first of all, I mean, like, marriage is an incredibly interesting topic, and Eli Finkel at Northwestern has done a terrific book on this called Nothing Marriage.
I love that book.
But one of the really interesting things, there's some research out of Emory showing an inverse relationship between how much a couple spends on their wedding ring, engagement ring and wedding, and the likelihood of the marriage succeeding. So the more you spend on the wedding, on the engagement ring and the wedding, the less likely the marriage is to succeed.
Is that the less likely? I was going to say if it was more likely, it'd be cognitive dissonance, but you're saying it's less likely to succeed.
Yeah, so the more you spend, the less likely it is to succeed. So expensive
why?
Wedding. Well, okay, so why? So, okay, first of all.
I would have predicted the opposite.
Okay, so this is great. Okay, this is great. So you would predict the opposite.
Because of cognitive dissonance.
Of course I'm in love with this person.
Yeah.
Look how much we
love
my marriage.
Yeah.
How could this marriage be falling apart? We had this glorious wedding,
right?
Exactly. How could this marriage be falling apart? I have this sparkly diamond ring.
That's right.
That's a great theory. The research shows the opposite. Now, causation.
Yeah.
You know, you're a scientist.
Yeah.
You have to be very, very skittish about causation if we're outside of a laboratory setting, right?
Sure.
Even if we're in a laboratory setting, we have to be very skittish about causation. But so I'll give you my initial hypothesis. It was that people who spent a lot on weddings and engagement rings had materialistic values, and materialistic values were antithetical to enduring marriages.
Oh,
and
I like that.
Okay, there seems to be zero evidence of that.
Oh, okay. People have controlled for like materialistic values in this regression.
There seems to be zero evidence of that.
Okay.
The reigning theory right now, and again, it's not even theory. The reigning speculation.
Yeah.
Right now is actually much more pedestrian, and it's this: that one of the things that we know causes marriages to break up, or at least accelerates marriages breaking up, is financial distress. And to me, the most persuasive argument here is that when couples spend a lot on their weddings and a lot on engagement rings, they go into debt. And as a consequence, they start their marriages under greater financial stress than a marriage where they spent less. And so it's really debt and financial stress that's the result of these expensive weddings and engagement rings that is driving it.
That's very sensible hypothesis. And one could think that, you know, you want to start your marriage off on a good foot. If you're starting it off broke because you've spent so much in your marriage, it's all going to kind of go downhill from there.
You know, there are all kinds of, you know, I've been married for 23 years. And so there are all kinds of happily married for 23 years, but there are all kinds of stressors on marriage, you know, and one of the biggest ones is financial stress. And so if you go from day one, it's like you're underwater from day one. That can, you know, up the odds. It doesn't guarantee you're going to get divorced. There are plenty of financially stressed people who have happy marriages, but it could up the odds of one getting divorced.
So interesting. Okay, just a few more. When should you exercise?
It depends on your goals. It seems like morning exercise is better if you want to lose weight, form a habit, or get an enduring mood boost. Because I think the last one is persuasive because, you know, exercise, particularly aerobic exercise, is a mood booster, and it can last for a fairly long time. You exercise late in the day, you sleep away the mood boost. Afternoon exercise seems to be better for avoiding injury. I think that's largely because of body temperature. Our body temperature goes up later in the day, and so you're literally more warmed up. It's better for performance. There's some interesting effects on lung function, hand-eye coordination, and speed at sort of late in the afternoon and early in the evening. And people also report enjoying it more in the late afternoon and early evening. Again, I think a lot of it has to do with body temperature. So it really depends. For morning exercise, for enduring mood boost, habit formation, and weight loss. Afternoon exercise for enjoying it more, performing better, and avoiding injury.
Cool. Okay, last question, and it's a bit of a cheeky framing.
Oh.
Are you ready? When is the best time to have a midlife crisis? Wasn't that a clever question?
Yeah, that was. That's a really good question. Well, I mean, you know that the midlife crisis, the brainchild of Elliot Jacques in the early 1960s, is complete bogosity. There's no evidence of a widespread crisis at middle age.
Sure.
There is something very intriguing that goes on across cultures, is that there's a U-shaped curve of well-being. So people actually, their subjective well-being dips a little bit in middle age, but no serious crisis. And I'm in my life now at the bottom of that U-shaped curve now. I'm at basically so everything is up for me from now on. Statistically, everything is up for me.
So, does that mean on average?
Yeah. So people in my population cohort, on average, are going to lift. I don't know if I will.
Oh, gotcha. Well, I hope you will. Hey, thanks a lot for the chat. This was a lot of fun, and I've had a lot of fun reading your work.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the questions, and I appreciate the dark alleys you walked down with me. I enjoyed it.
Yay, me too.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of The Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.